Will the owner of the great big butt please move it out of my face?
Of the Starship Enterprise, its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Red. says it's the end of time. And the Mississippi River, she's a gold dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women old boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. And we can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. Pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Cause you can't stop us out and you can't make them run, cause we're them old boys raised on shotguns. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. And we can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Six, five, four, three, two, one, zero, blast off! is going on in here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, Shaziz here. I'm out here in my mad science laboratory. How's it going out there? I've got Muddy Mudman calling in, and Thomas. Are you there, Thomas? Hey, I even got Dublin in there. Anybody there?
Yeah. How's it going?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Yeah, I'm good. Nice in Spain. Bit windy today, but very nice.
Well, I guess it could be worse, huh?
Exactly.
Well, I saw Muddy calling in there. I don't know what happened with him there. Hopefully he'll make it back in. So anyway, I hope everybody's doing well out there. I sent a link into the chat room over there at ShazizRadio.com. Talks about spontaneous human combustion. What do you think about that, Dublin? Are you there?
I did a bit of research on it, and it looks like it can happen. It probably is due to some sort of chemical reaction that we don't fully understand in the human being, and only some humans might be susceptible to that particular type of chemical reaction. So I don't think everybody better start rushing out there and getting into panic and carrying a fire extinguisher with them.
No, but it is a very interesting subject. They call it a phenomena. But you know, if you think about it, I'm always saying that the body is energy. You know, you got 3/4 water in your body. That's hydrogen and oxygen. Plus, the body creates a bit of methane, and there's other chemicals involved. Plus, there's a lot of electricity going on in your body at any given time. So, I can see where it could be plausible. What do you think?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, you only got to look at the history of humanity to realize that you know, we can do really weird and wonderful things, but not all of us have the full gifts that can do all these things. Or I mean, some of us can move objects by looking at them. I mean, there definitely seems to be proof there.
Yeah, but I don't see the spontaneous human combustion portion being a gift.
No, I would call it an unfortunate side effect. You know, some people seem to have more energy, and whatever chemical reaction is going on, it gets out of line, and poof, you're gone. But I mean, you have to pay attention now with the new weapons that they have. They got these kind of like guns. They fire a laser at you. It's not the laser that kills you. They fire an energy ball down the laser beam. It's a bit like you know the way fiber optics will, as the signal goes down the glass fiber, it reflects off the walls, and so it can go many miles without loss of a signal, and then it goes to an amplifier, which again sends it down another glass fiber. So you can literally make light go around corners. You know, if you put a glass strand, you ever see those things in the shop with glass, long glass things, and on the end of it, a lovely little color?
Yeah.
It's the same thing with this laser weapon. They fire the laser at you, and then they fire an energy beam down the center of the laser. And the laser contains the energy beam. Now, when the energy beam hits the target, probably you or some other unfortunate human being, it will burn a bloody huge hole, and the hole will be about the size of a dinner plate.
Man. So,
And that's all the new energy weapons that they've developed in DARPA and all these other places. They ain't telling us the half of what they got.
Oh, I'm sure of that, man. You know, on this spontaneous human combustion thing, you know, it's not like we don't have enough to worry about in the world to sit along sitting there busting into flames one day.
Yeah. But I think realistically, I mean, the amount of people that burst into flames is quite few. It's probably in the low hundreds over several hundred years. So any new cases that pop up, I would be inclined to think they got zapped from outer space by a satellite from DARPA or somebody like that.
Well, nothing in this world would surprise me. I also saw a documentary about some of the energy weapons that they use. Like, there was one they put these big burly Marines in front of and seen how long they could stand there when they turned this thing on. And they said that it made them feel like they were on fire inside. And so they could only stand there for like a couple seconds before they wanted to get the heck out of the way. I mean, what better crowd control can you get than that? You know, you don't like what somebody's talking about, you just zap them with one of those, and everybody's dancing around trying to get out of the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they've used that in Iraq. I mean, they pointed it at a bus, and they literally cook all the people inside the bus because, you know, they make sure they can't get out. So they know that eventually the weapon will cook you. And my intel is that the reason many people were jumping out of the New York skyscrapers in 9/11 was there was some sort of beam being sent down on top of them. Everybody, every documentary you look at, they all complain of heat, tremendous heat inside the building. So it looks like before the building was knocked down by some sort of giant laser beam from outer space by a satellite up there, they were building up the energy inside the building. And this is why a lot of people were jumping out, because what would happen is a lot of them would take their clothes off to get rid of the feeling of being so hot. And then what they would do is, the sprinklers had gone off, they would stand underneath the water to get cool. And that was the worst thing they could do, because these microwaves would then heat up the water on their skin and start to scald them alive. And that was why there were quite a few of them were jumping out of the building, because they were actually, as far as they were concerned, on fire. And some of them were so cooked by the whole process, they're probably hanging out the window, that they eventually let go because the cooking was too much for them, and they were dead before they even fell. So apparently, generally dead people will fall head first, and there was quite a few people that were surprised that some of the people falling out of the building were falling head first. That would suggest they were dead before they even left the building. Man. So there's substantial proof that the, best bit of proof I have that they laser beam 9/11 or some sort of energy beam. Building number 6 is the one nobody talks about. Building number 6, if you look at it, it looks like a huge laser beam went right down through the middle of it. All the four walls are still standing on around the edge, but there's a huge hole in the middle of it. And then there was no aeroplane hit building number 6. The building didn't fall down on the outside. It just fell down on the inside.
How many buildings total fell?
Well, this is it. I only discovered the other day that building number 6 was also affected. Three buildings fell down. Building the two towers and building number 7. But building number 6, they claimed, caught fire. In actual fact, it was bugger all fire. But the whole center of it got melted away as if a huge energy beam hit it right down the middle, which would, of course, made the demolition work substantially easier, because all you now had was the four walls on the outside to knock down. You didn't have to knock down the center of the building. You know what I mean? I talked to a guy who was in the skyscrapers when they were being assembled, and when they reached the 88th floor, they already knew that the buildings were going to be condemned, because the buildings were swaying too much. They were swaying far more than the plans had let on that they would, and this would make everybody in the top floors quite seasick. And he said that when you went up to the towers, when they were finally built, you went to the top floors and you went into the toilet, you could see the water swishing around inside the toilet from the building swaying. Do you mean?
Wow.
And it was very hard to rent space on the top floors because their building was swaying so much. And this meant that they knew in 1978 or 9, when the buildings were finished, that they were only going to have a short lifespan. They were not going to go for their full 50-year design life.
Well, and the building was... It was kind of...
The buildings, to my knowledge, only had a 50% occupancy rate, and most of the people who occupied it were government officers like FBI, CIA, you know, all the alphabet strings, and a few of the big bad boys in Wall Street like J.P. Morgan and sections like that.
Well, it was kind of ironic that the owner of the buildings actually went out prior to it and... bought a insurance policy with a double indemnity on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that too. I mean, there's everything. You know, everything tells you that it was a sure hit. The more you dig into 9/11, the more you come up with dirt. Every which way you go, you come up with dirt. But 9/11 didn't go according to plan. The original plan was that Secretary of Defense at the time, what the hell was his name? Rumsfeld. He was supposed to be in the office where the aeroplane hit on the Pentagon. because that's where his office is. It's right where the airplane hits. Because the day before, they released that there was $2 trillion missing. And so needless to say, Rumfield should have been in that office with all his accountants who were looking for these missing $2 trillion. So, of course, if that had gone according to plan and Rumsfeld had got killed, you would have had two buildings knocked down. You would have had Rumsfeld dead, you know, Secretary of Defense, the Pentagon, the most secure building in the world. And the idea was probably to bring in a state of emergency, whatever. You know what I mean?
Speaking about secure buildings, you know, they just put out this deal about the Sandy Hook episode here recently. The skinny kid, remember back whenever they first started talking about all that supposed school shooting over there? They said the kid kicked the front door in and went in and started blasting people?
Yeah.
Well, they released a supposed video of the surveillance video of the school. Of course, this is like after the police already showed up. Now, they showed the front door. It's wide open, but it's not kicked open. There's no busted glass or anything like that. And somebody inside was panning around with the camera and trying to show some bullets that were on the concrete there. Seemed pretty scripted to me. But either way, they released all this supposed information and pictures and stuff of the crime scene and the... And they said that the doggone investigation's over, and then as you're watching all this information everything's redacted. You can't see this because it's redacted or whatever. You know, there was more redacted in there. All you could see is basically a looked like a abandoned school with a bunch of cars around it. Anyway, it don't surprise me none what you're talking about on that other side there.
Yeah, I think I saw a recent photograph of the school, an aerial photograph, and it showed it completely demolished now.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to bury the scene there so that nobody else can investigate.
Well, I mean, this is the ultimate. I mean, it's what they did with 9/11 was they got rid of all the evidence. Now there is no building, so you know, all the metal's gone, all the concrete's gone. You can't prove anything. Well, and
from what I understand, that was a pretty fast cleanup that they did on that.
Well, it was so bloody fast, you'd have to say to yourself, you know, did they have the contracts already lined up? I mean, that was a million tons of stuff had to be moved rapidly from New York.
Yeah, you know. So usually should
the
take...
other thing, or several million tons, I can't remember the full amount. I mean, they did get rid of 90% of the concrete because the energy that was beamed into the buildings literally caused the concrete to turn into a dust. Because no explosive would generally do that. Explosive will it'll pulverize concrete to some extent, but not to the extent that it would literally turn to dust. The some guy who's a mathematician explained the formula for demolition and how much force is required to turn concrete into dust. And you couldn't put that much explosive into the building. Literally the whole building would be explosive.
Well, I've actually seen some implosions before, and I stood on site while they took down these old government housing buildings or whatever. And it breaks it all down, but it does. There's still huge chunks left. You know what I mean?
That's right. The normal rule with demolition is 12% will be the height of the rubble field. So if your building's 100 stories tall, when it falls into rubble, it will be 12 stories tall, plus or minus. Now the World Trade Towers broke all the rules because it was not even 5 stories tall. So, and 90% of the concrete literally went into the city, you know, as dust. Now, only an incredibly powerful energy beam could possibly do that.
Yeah.
You just couldn't put enough explosive into a building to do that. It was just mathematically nearly impossible.
Well, there definitely was a whole lot of dust, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see, this is the strange thing about it. I mean, even the day it happened, I said to myself, where the hell did all that dust come from? I mean, everything that was happening that day was beyond my logic in that the planes hit the building. I knew the buildings were 250,000 tons. A 500-ton plane hitting a building of 250,000 tons is a bit like a bird hitting your car. It might put a dent in your car, you know, your radiator or something. You know, but your car is not going to fall to pieces like you see in those old-fashioned movies, Charlie Chaplin movies, you know. I mean, it's not going to happen. So, the buildings could take 3 airplanes hitting them without any bother. So, I mean, the first thing I said to everybody that day was, well, there'll be a fire, they've got to get everybody out, the buildings might burn for a week, and then they'll have to demolish them.
Well, from what I understand,
when they fell down, I was sort of like, what the hell?
From what I understand,
I'm looking stupid.
Those buildings were actually designed to take a hit from an airplane.
Well, this is it. They were designed to take a hit. And in actual fact, as one guy who's an expert on the subject said, and I go along with him now, having looked the whole subject, he said that if you actually flew a real airplane into the side of the building, the plane would have basically stopped and slid down the side of the building. That's how bloody powerfully built those buildings were. Because the amount of windows relative to the amount of solid wall was quite little in order to conserve energy. The outside of the building was clad with quite thick concrete walls, and the amount of windows was quite small. So basically what would have happened is the front half of the plane might have got through some of the window space, through the slits. The two engines would have continued through because they're titanium, and they would have got punched their way through. But the rest of the airplane would have come to a stop and just literally slid down the side of the building. So well, mathematically, it's impossible that a real airplane hit the buildings, because if you watch them, they just sort of disappear into the building.
Speaking of that,
yeah.
Speaking of that, the Pentagon one, that's the one that got me baffled, because if a plane's coming in there at 500 miles an hour at the altitude by which it would have to fly to actually slam through the side of that building, I'm just like thinking about the whole laws of physics going on there, the gravitational pull of the Earth. If somebody coming in that low, normally you don't have the pressure underneath the wings to hold you up, so you usually get sucked to the ground. So there should have been a whole lot more parts on that front lawn, especially whenever you think about they had these big light poles out there, galvanized metal light poles that went up against an aluminum airplane coming in at 500 miles an hour. It should have shredded a few pieces off laying out there on the lawn, wouldn't you think?
Oh yeah, look, the first rule is there's no passenger jet airplane that can do 500 mile an hour at sea level. You know, if it tries to do it, it's going to lose its wings, because people don't understand the force of aerodynamics. If you go into a very steep dive with any airplane, every airplane's got what's called a VNE, a speed not to be exceeded, the maximum speed. So when you go into a dive, if you exceed that speed limit, you will cause the wings to generate so much lift that they'll cause the wings to break off. And it's a mathematical formula. So every plane you step into will always have what's called VNE, the maximum speed you do not exceed. And it'll state two speeds if it's a passenger airline, because they fly at high heights. A small airplane will only say one speed, because you don't really fly high with those. The passenger ones will say VNE 350 knots at sea level, and maybe 700 knots high up, because the air is half the thickness high up, so you get half the lift. So if you want to get the same amount of forces, you have to double your speed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why airplanes fly fast high up, because the air is very thin, and so even though the top speed low down is probably about 350 mile an hour, you know, that's really pushing it. I doubt they can even do that. There's when they go high up, even though they're going flat out, if you look at the speed indicator, it'll still say 350 mile an hour, even though it's doing, say, 700 mile an hour, because the air is half the thickness, and the gadget that measures the air force pressing against the speed sensor will say, you know, just mathematically calculate at sea level. So if you want to know your true speed, you have to look at other instruments. But as far as the air is concerned, it's only doing 350 mile an hour, even if the plane's doing 700 mile an hour at high heights. I know it's not very logical for most people, but there's another problem with the modern jetliners, is they have huge big engines. They're called turbofan engines now. In the old days, if you look at the old 707s, they have a very small, narrow little jet engine. You know, they call them the coal burners. And they're very good at very high altitudes. They produce a lot of thrust at high speed, high up in you know, 40,000 feet. But they're useless on the runway where the air is thick and you're trying to push the airplane to get up to speed to take off. So to solve that problem, the modern engines have a big, light propeller attached to the jet engine that passes more air over the outside of the engine. And this is called a turbofan because it's like a big fan. And it does two things. It supplies more thrust and it supplies cold air over the outside of the engine, which mixes with the hot air coming out of the jet engine and makes the engine much more quiet. But there's a price you pay for that. The increase in thrust gives you a reduction in speed. And that shows up particularly when you're at low altitude. If you try going faster at low altitude, the air is so thick and the turbofan is so big that you start to build up a wall of air in front of the engine, and literally the air cannot get into the engine because the engine's acting like a brake. Now these turbofans are very large, so if you put a passenger airplane into a dive from say 5,000 feet, you basically will find once it gets to about 400 miles an hour, that's as fast as it can go because the wall of air in front of the engines is acting like a huge air brake. And that's if the wings still stay on the airplane at that stage, because the normal VNE is 350 miles an hour. Now the lift that's been generated on the wings is colossal. The plane might weigh, say, I don't know, say 100 odd tons or 150 tons, whatever, maybe 200, say tops. The lift in the wings could be 1,000 tons. So you've now got 1,000 tons of lift, trying to lift 200 tons, and the wings start to literally bend upwards, and eventually they snap off. And that's why they have these VNE things, you know what I mean? They know the limits of these airplanes.
So do you think that it's plausible that a passenger jet could have flew that low to actually make that impact site on the Pentagon?
Well, there's only two possibilities. One is a passenger jet flew that low and was doing 350 mile an hour and slammed into the building, right?
Yeah.
In other words, a real jet flying at 350 mile an hour slammed into the building. The other possibility is will be an extremely modified passenger jet, which is designed to fly at 500 mile an hour in a dive. Well, you know, beefed up wings. I mean, we're talking serious modifications. You'd have to double the strength of the wings. You'd have to probably stop the turbofans working and just use jet engines inside the turbine fan, you know. You're talking serious modifications. And then you would have to maybe make steel girders for the fuselage so that they could punch their way through the building, and steel girders in the wings to punch their way through the building. So they're the only two possibilities if you're talking about a real aircraft hitting the building. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
now, I don't go with any of those two possibilities. It's too much time, too much trouble, and too risky. It won't work. Do me.
Yeah, I still think that at some point there should have been some debris all over the front lawn of that thing, because as slow as it was to the ground, I could see maybe it bouncing and skipping, but there still would be busted parts and maybe seats and junk laying all over the doggone thing, you know, luggage or whatever.
Well, this is it. More than that, as the plane comes that close to the ground, it would have a huge cushion of air, which would effectively make the plane bounce. You know, the cushion of air, the wall of air that would be underneath the plane, if it was doing 300, 400, 500 mile an hour, once it got to within 50 feet of the ground, the wall of air would literally cause the plane to bounce back up to 200 feet. You know, it's like if you've got a hovercraft, and you're going along and you hit a rock, you know, say a rock that's protruding up of the ground by, say, 6 inches, the nose of your hovercraft will rise a bit higher to go over the, you know, the rock that you're passing over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Force the air. It's the same with an aircraft like that. As soon as they come within what's called ground effect, it's like a huge cushion of air. And, I mean, big planes like jumbos, they use that to their advantage because it cushions their landings. You know, just before they land, they rotate the nose up, and you get a big wall of air underneath the wings, and it acts like a huge cushion. And then the plane sits down on the runway very gently. And that's on at 120 mile an hour flaps. Now, if you come in at 350, 400 mile an hour, close to the ground, flying over a runway, and you build up this wall of air in front of you, as you get within 50 feet of the runway, the sheer wall of air will cause the plane to bounce back up to 200 feet. You're not going to hit a target. It's just not an option. You're going to pass clean over any object that's, you know, it's just one of those laws of gravity or laws of aerodynamics.
You know, one other thing that strikes me odd is that they talked about how these guys learned how to fly Cessnas, but they did not learn how to land. So, first off, why would you even try to fly a plane and not learn how to land? That should have been a red flag from the get-go. But landing...
No, I mean, as far as I'm now adhered to what's known in the school of 9/11 truthers as there was no real aeroplane as such that hit any of the buildings.
Well, yeah, but my point is this. If you're going to land a Cessna, that's one thing. That's a small airplane.
That's right.
And but if you're going to land, what was it, 747s?
Yeah. These aren't 747s. These were 757s and 767s, which are, I think they're 767 might be about 200-ton plane.
All right, but either way, that's a whole different ball game when you're talking about landing something that big, and so accuracy is going to be the key. Now, you know, if you're going to be... Unless all these guys were extremely lucky, then some of them should have missed. You know, grazed off the side of the building or something like that. But these were pretty accurate guys for not learning how to land Cessnas, but being able to control like a missile a big old, you know, passenger jet. You see where I'm coming from?
Oh yeah, look, there's no way. If I gave you a flight simulator and I said, here's a big plane, and I put up a simulation of the World Trade Towers, and I said, point at it and try and crash into it, your chances of hitting the building are only about 1 in 10, at best. You know what I mean? Now, professional pilots have tried it, and they find that exactly what happens is that the plane gets extremely unstable when you're going very fast, because it wasn't designed to fly in a straight line at high speed at low altitude. They're designed to fly at high speed in a straight line at high altitude, or at a slow speed in a straight line at low altitude. But none of these passenger planes are designed to fly at high speed in a straight line. And it's a bit like your normal run-of-the-mill car. If you bring it on a dirt road with lots of ruts in the road and you go down it at 70 mile an hour, your chances of keeping it on the road, if there's lots of bumps and, you know, this, that, and the other...
Yeah, you're going to wipe out.
Pretty slim. You're going to probably slide off at some stage. It's the same with a big aeroplane. You fly at, say, 400 mile an hour with the wings trying to tear themselves off, and the whole plane shaking shaking enough to knock your fillings out, your chance that even your vision will be blurred. I mean, you'd be bouncing up and down them chairs like nobody's business. You know that way, like if you were sitting on top of a big machine.
Okay, so these guys, they learned how to fly Cessnas. They got on these jets and they took some box knives. They were able to overtake all the pilots and crew of all these different planes. They were all successful in that because they had these box knives, and they were able to pinpoint accurate blast into the side of these buildings and all this kind of jazz.
No, Hollywood. So, basically, none of those guys got on any of the planes. They were all CIA agents. They're all CIA operatives. They were all trained.
Well, regardless,
they were trained to go to the airport, put their face in front of a camera in the airport, and then they simply didn't get on the planes.
Regardless of all that, that's what the official story would have you believe. You know, like spontaneous combustion.
It's hilarious. The more you dig into it, the more hilarious it becomes.
It's like this spontaneous human combustion thing. I put a little message inside the chat room there at Shaziz, and they said it's among the most controversial of phenomenons. You know?
Yeah, I've looked at it over many, many years, and I do think there's some evidence it does happen.
Well,
usually the main ingredient in people burning up is that they usually have had some drink taken. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think it necessarily requires that as well, because first off, body fat, oil, whatever, you got so many different flammables in your body, including methane, whenever you've eaten a lot of, let's say you ate a can of Cowboy Billy baked beans, you got some methane building up inside there, That stuff's flammable.
Yeah.
And once you do get oil or grease on fire, they tell you not to throw water on a grease fire because it'll spread. And so with that said, you've got oxygen, you've got hydrogen, and different chemicals in your body. If you was to get your body burning like a candle, it would just basically engulf itself. So I see where it's scientifically plausible.
Oh, yeah. It's, the main thing that's noticeable about nearly all spontaneous combustion is it's the middle of the body that catches fire, and the legs and the arms are generally not burnt up too much.
Well, and then you also threw in the factor of alcohol. You throw alcohol in the system,
yeah.
Alcohol burns as well.
Oh, alcohol burns very nicely, thank you very much. So, now there's a lot of reasons why you shouldn't burn, because a lot of water in the body to smother the flames, et cetera, et cetera. Getting the temperatures up, yada, yada, yada. But there does seem to be enough proof that occasionally one person in every, billion or so many million can spontaneously burst into fire given a set of certain circumstances, as of yet have not been fully established. Now, what those circumstances are is hard to say. I mean, people do burst into fire from other circumstances, like lightning hits them. Big enough bolt of lightning hits you, you catch on fire.
Well, think about this for a second. There's electricity going through the body. Right?
Yeah.
Well, you'd also know that you can build up a static charge, and you can run around and you can get a big, powerful arc across something. So
that's right.
There's an ignition source. I'm holding on to a set of capacitors right now. I'm actually holding on to the leads of the capacitor, which is connected to a voltmeter, and I'm averaging anywhere from 20.7 millivolts all the way up to 50-some-odd millivolts, sitting here having a conversation, charging these capacitors, just holding them in my hand. So we know there's electricity moving through the body. So if the chemistry in the body for some reason or another went awry, all you would need then would be an ignition source. You got to have oxygen, you got to have a fuel source, and you got to have an ignition source in order to create a fire. You see what I'm saying?
And alcohol is an unusual fuel because alcohol contains 30% of the alcohol molecule is oxygen. So it's nearly what you would call a self-combusting fuel. Like, for example, if you put gasoline into a cylinder, you need 15 parts of air to one part of gasoline. Because gasoline has no oxygen in the molecule. It's all carbon and hydrogen rings. Alcohol, when you put it into the engine, you only need 8 parts of air to one part of alcohol. Because the alcohol fuel, one-third of it is already oxygen molecule, so it doesn't need as much oxygen from the atmosphere to burn. And that's what makes it a very useful and powerful fuel, and that's why the racing guys use it. If you've got oxygen in your fuel, then you need to catch less air from the atmosphere so your engine can give you more power. It doesn't have to drag in so much air.
Well, also, alcohol absorbs into the bloodstream as well.
That's it. So if you put alcohol, say, into the stomach, and there's some chemical reaction, be it hydrochloric acid that's in your stomach or some ignition source, as of yet not fully understood, and the fire starts in your stomach, and the rest of you is already, you know, primed, you know, you've got your body fats and the food that's maybe in there, you know, a lot of these stuff will burn pretty easily. And, you know, you get the right set of circumstances, then, yeah. And when you look at all these spontaneous combustions, it's the central core of the body that gets burnt out. You know, the head is not burnt off, the legs aren't burnt off, and the arms aren't burnt. It's just the central core of the body that gets totally burnt up.
Yeah, and one other thing to point out is the body temperature is like 98.6 degrees, so you've already got the beginnings of heat going on there.
That's right. I mean, you've got a lot of heat sources. I mean, the body is burning fuel. It's taking sugar and it's taking oxygen, putting them inside a cell, and setting fire to them. Every cell is burning fuel. You know, it's taking oxygen and taking glucose. And glucose is very flammable. If you throw it on top of fire, you want to see how it makes the fire jump up. You know,
yeah.
There's a lot of carbon and hydrogen molecules in it.
And they do talk about burning off fat when you exercise.
Yeah. And so that's why I say mathematically it's very, very difficult to create ignition in the body. But if you do get the right set of circumstances, they all come together. These billion to one chances all come together. It's like getting the lotto. You win the lotto. Billion to one chance, or you're unlucky and you're billion to one chance, all these things come together and you burn up. You know.
So, but, yeah. So, back to the whole 9/11 episode with all these deals, would you say the odds are that I would spontaneously combust faster than somebody could actually fly one of these planes in the side of the Pentagon without leaving some debris on the front lawn after running through light poles?
Bursting into fire than the Hollywood story of 9/11. I mean, somebody's a bad scriptwriter.
Well, and
whoever the Pentagon or the New World Order scriptwriter is, he's a crap scriptwriter.
Yeah, and yeah. So this is why, you know, I call it mad science, man, because when you listen to the official stories and then you add the basic science in there, you know, things just don't seem to add up, because you were sitting here talking about all the different methods by which a plane stays in the air or a body could actually spontaneously combust, and their official story just doesn't match up to the basic science portion of it. Forget the laws of physics. I mean, just go to the basic science. You know, basic science is if you got a plane that doggone heavy and it's that close to the ground, it's going to crack up before it ever even gets to the ground. When you actually look at the hole in the side of the Pentagon, the height level at which it was flying pretty doggone low to the ground. Now,
what actually happened in the Pentagon is pretty obvious now. They've planted some sort of large bomb beside the building, maybe a truck bomb or a, you know, maybe they put an oil tank there, you know, whatever.
Whatever
they put beside the building was a bomb, and it was, then they flew in some sort of drone, maybe a
Yeah, but see, listen.
A small aircraft with maybe with two propellers or something like that, or two small jet engines.
Yeah, but
gave the impression that there was a crash.
Yeah, but listen, listen, Dublin.
That's it. I mean, there's no evidence that a large plane hit it. Possibly a very small plane hit it, and then the bomb was designed to go off at the same time.
Yeah, but listen. See,
and all the telephone poles were probably knocked over by Hollywood stuntmen.
Yeah, but listen, Devlin. All conspiracy theories aside, all we have to work with is the official story. See, the official story, this is the evidence presented to us. This is all we have to work with. So everything else beside that would be speculation. Just using the official story, basic science, and the way that the buildings came down, and all the observations that were made by not just a few people, but thousands of people throughout the entire world, the whole story stinks, you know, just using basic science alone.
One end to the other, as you pick through the story, every piece of the story doesn't work. I mean, every single piece of the story is completely doesn't work. It's, I mean, you find out that all the planes that were supposed to have crashed into the building are still, or they were still flying up till the year 2007. So that means they never crashed into any building. Half the people that were, the FBI said, that hijacked the planes stood up and said, I'm very much alive and I'm in whatever country and I don't know what the FBI is talking about. And of course, the FBI can't arrest them because they're supposed to be dead hijackers. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if they're alive in some other country in the world, well, then they can't be a dead hijacker. They can't have been a hijacker. And so, I mean, that's 50% of the people they said were hijackers are now running around the world quite happy, saying, I don't know anything what the FBI is talking about. I wasn't there. I'm pretty alive, and I was in this country or that country or the other country. So, I mean, every part of the story stinks.
Well,
but unfortunately, the public are dumbass. You know, there's no other words you can use for it. They look at the TV, plane hits building falls down, very sad, who won the football game? You know, that's it. I mean, that's the public. You know, whether it's Europe or America or any other part of the world, most other parts of the world, who won the football game?
So I'm guessing a lot unless somebody just actually burst into flames, they'll never believe that's possible either.
Well, this is it. You have to research the subject and choose yourself. It's personal decision time there. I mean, as I always say, I was in the Canary Islands. The Berlin Wall fell down, and I was watching on TV, and I said to one of the barmen working at the bar, I said, isn't it wonderful? You know, the wall fell down, and he said, what wall? You know, so that was as much as he knew about the rest of the world. You know what I mean? He didn't even know there was a wall in Berlin. You know what I mean? Never heard of the wall in Berlin. Didn't even know it had fallen down. So what can you do with that? You know, and that's the level of knowledge of 90% or maybe 95% of the world population.
Well, that's kind of unfortunate because we're losing out on a whole lot of possibilities. You know, people would actually get out there and start using their brain for something other than keeping track of Dancing with the Stars or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or whatever like that, you know, and actually looking into all kinds of different ideas. You know, this could be a better world as far as I'm concerned. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, well, luckily we don't have to get 90% of the people to change the world. The statistics show that if you can get 10% of the people to believe something, the other 90% start to believe that idea. So if the Americans can get 10% of the Americans to believe that 9/11 was a complete, you know, hocus-pocus job done by various people like the New World Order, and that the federal government is trying to stick them into FEMA extermination camps, and, you know, it's time to get rid of the federal government, that they're out of control, and get rid of the Federal Reserve, then that's it, it's over. The Federal Reserve goes, and the federal government gets put back down to its correct size, which is its three functions it's only allowed to do. defend outside the country, the minting of the legal tender, and something else I can't remember. But there's only three functions the federal government should be doing. But in 1871, it got hijacked and made into a commercial corporation, Washington, D.C. Corporation. And it doesn't operate under the Bill of Rights, and it doesn't operate under the USA Constitution. It operates under what's called, I'm trying to remember the name, there's a special term for it. It's like bureaucracy. Administrative rights. So, if you're in Washington, D.C., and they say to you, you cannot be armed, it's quite possible they're right, because Washington, D.C. is a special area where the federal government is in charge. But anywhere else in America, if they say you can't carry weapons, they're wrong, because the Constitution applies there. But what Washington, D.C. has done is it has extended its power from beyond Washington, D.C., and everything now is administrative rights. So when you go to the airport, that's federal property, and they say, it's Washington, D.C. you're in, so there's no Fourth Amendment. We can search you under administrative rights. And then basically by turning all America into Washington, D.C. with administrative rights and corporation rules, there is no Bill of Rights, and there is no USA Constitution. There's only the corporate body, and they're the top guys, and that's it. You shut your mouth. And you see how this deception works.
Well, it's crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's crazy, but if enough people understand how it works, they can reverse it.
Well, then, a lot of people don't realize that Washington, D.C. is the District of Columbia, which is a separate entity from the United States.
Yeah, it's a complete separate entity. That's what they did in 1870 or 1871 or something like that. They changed Washington, D.C. from a normal USA state or whatever to a special corporation.
Hey, Dublin.
And everything now in federal government is basically like Coca-Cola Corporation. You know, you have the president is not really the president of America. He's the president of Washington, D.C. State Corporation Limited. You know, whatever you want to call it, for profit.
Hey, Doug.
He has to make a profit first. And then if he's a bit of profit left over and he wants to, you know, he's promised to poor people this side or the other, and there's a bit of profit left over, he can give it to them. But first he has to make the profit. And if there isn't enough profit to give to poor people, well, then he'll just have to renege on his promises.
Dublin, yeah. I'm trying to add Muddy to the call. Can you add him in there on your side?
I don't know how to. If you can tell me how, I'll try.
Well, it should be a plus sign down there on your Skype, and you click on that, and it says add people.
Okay, what do I do? Do I just press the plus? See
what
happens?
Yeah.
Okay. Add people.
Hi. Right.
Click on add people to this call. Right. Yeah, okay. Oh, show. Thomas is there, but he's gone away. Buddy Mudman is there, but in green.
Yeah, click on him.
You're talking about.
Click on Muddy Muddy Mud Man and add him to the call.
All right, I'll add him to the call.
All right, well, everybody, you're listening to Shazia's Mad Science here.
Muddy, are you there? It's still like signaling that he's trying to contact him.
Yeah, I don't know what's on his side, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the whole spontaneous human combustion thing. You know, people just sitting around suddenly burst into flames, and then you got the controversial discussions about it. People arguing to and fro, or whatever. Science guys are saying, even doctors are saying, there's too much water in the human body to burst into flames. But this just gives me a headache.
Well, there's a lot of other weird things in the world besides human combustion. I mean, there's you know, things like ESP. Like the American Army discovered a very interesting fact, that they took all these Indian guys from the reserves who were great trackers and had great instinct and for some reason could know that the enemy was behind that rock, you know, and it would turn out they were correct. And they brought them into the American Army, and as soon as they brought them into the American Army, they all lost their ability to do this, and they couldn't figure out what this was all about. And the only thing they could figure out is that when they took them into the army, they cut off all their hair and their beard and what have you. So they said, okay, let's do a double blind test. Let's take in the native guys, and one half of the group will give them the crew cut, and the other half of the group we'll leave them have their normal long hair and their normal beard and what have you. And the guys who got their hair cut off, they lost their extrasensory abilities, and the guys who they left their hair on didn't lose their extrasensory abilities. So whatever it is that's in their hair, it's obviously acting like some sort of massive antenna. And so by cutting off their hair, they were reducing their ability to function as well as normal. So even the American Army now will, you know, when they take in these kind of guys who seem to have these special abilities of tracking and knowing what's bad, they won't cut their hair. Everybody else will get a crew cut, but not these Indian guys, you know, these native Indians, you know.
Well, you know, there's a story in the Bible about Samson, and he got his strength from his hair, so I wonder if that's connected.
Well, this is it. I mean, I've grown a beard, and I don't know. I discovered it's biblical to keep your beard. You know, it's in the Bible there. Apparently, cutting your face, you know, smooth skin, is appealing to the, you know, this gay, lesbian, something or other, LBGT, or whatever they call them, that lot. That's apparently... in the old days, it was the gay people would tend to shave. I mean,
well, I don't know about all. I don't know about all that. All I know is there's a lot of strange stuff going on, and I believe that human body is capable of a whole lot more than we're told.
Oh yeah, look. I mean, you would not believe the things that the human body has been known to do. You know, on all sorts of occasions.
I've got an example too. I watched another documentary about this guy that had a 1,250-pound flat rock fall on him as he was climbing up a face of a cliff. The rock busted loose and landed on him, and somehow or another, he was able to, before he was drug off the cliff by the rock that was sliding down, was able to muster up every bit of energy in his body, focus it all into his muscles, and shove that rock off the top of him.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I had an uncle-in-law, and he was working in his bakery, you know, and he had a big machine, and he was working in there by himself on a Saturday or a Sunday or something. And anyway, something went wrong, and the big machine fell over and fell on top of his legs. And somehow or other, he managed to exert enough force to push the machine to one side and get out from under the machine, and then drag himself across the floor and pick up the phone, because in those days there was no mobile phones. There was no, you know, it was just the old-fashioned dial-up things, and call for help. But they couldn't believe, you know, it took like four guys to shift that machine. You know, it was really heavy. And they don't know where he found the strength to lift it off of himself, you know. And but if he hadn't done that, he'd have been trapped under the machine for the minimum 6 hours, probably for a day, before anybody realized that he was missing. And that would have killed him, because, you know, he spent like a year in hospital, you know. His legs were totally crushed, you know.
Yeah, you always hear stories about people lifting cars off of people in accidents, or ripping doors off and stuff like that. And so with that said, you know, there's something going on out there.
Well, I mean, you look at an animal like a chimpanzee. A chimpanzee is incredibly powerful. It can rip your arm out of your socket. You know what I mean?
Well, I would suggest then you don't make a chimpanzee mad.
Well, I would definitely recommend. But, I mean, a lot of people think, chimpanzee, you know, a nice little animal and yada, 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 and so forth. No way. They, you know, if they exert their strength, they can rip your arm clean out of your socket. They are really powerful, even though their arms are only the same size as ours generally.
It's another good reason not to give a monkey a gun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know a guy, and he saw this. He said he saw baboons. Now, if you look at baboons, they got pretty powerful big teeth. And there was one time a leopard was coming after the... Because normally baboons sit around, you know, they're like a tribe. There'll be 50 of them. They move around in a group of anywhere between 20 and 100 of them. Sometimes 200. But 50 is a kind of an average number in a troop. You know, the... there was a cliff face, and the cheetah or leopard or whatever it was, one of these large cats, was going for the troop and would probably be able to snack on one or two of the smaller baboons. So all the baboons naturally climbed up the cliff, and this leopard came after them. So three of the baboons, the biggest, the male ones, they turned around and they went for the leopard, and okay, two of them got killed, but one of them got on the throat of the cheetah and ripped its throat out.
Man.
You know, I mean, that's a much bigger animal than a baboon. So it shows you that when animals decide, you know, a baboon decides to turn on you, even a full-grown male would have a job. I mean, you want to think twice.
Well, you know, with all that genetic altering stuff going on, genetic modifications going on around it, wouldn't it be, like, cool if you could, like, get yourself genetically modified to where you had teeth like a baboon, hair like a chimpanzee, and legs like a chicken?
I don't think you'll go down too well in a video with the chicks. I don't think they'll be into that. Something or other.
Yeah, you won't be getting popular anytime soon, would you?
yeah, I just don't see it going down as a new fashion somehow or other. But the American Army is doing experiments like that. They have what they call the Super Soldier Program. Soldiers who can tolerate extreme pain, you know, like way beyond normal. I think they're a mix of some sort of animals and some sort of humans, so they're not strictly humans anymore. And they can run like 200 miles nonstop, and you know, you wouldn't know what they're doing in DARPA these days. They're off their trolleys.
Well, I'll tell you, nothing would surprise me these days. I'm, you know, thumbing through a little magazine where you actually buy fruits and vegetable and trees and stuff like that, and now they got these trees that'll grow several different fruits on it and that kind of stuff. So, you know, basically tampering around with nature, you know, modifying it like that. So I don't see any reason why they actually couldn't modify, you know, humans as well, which to me is kind of creepy.
They're doing it. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. There's ample evidence that they're experimenting with mixing different animals with humans and coming up with what they call chimp-humans or something, or chumans or some weird name like that. And
well, just think they put growth hormones in cows to make cows produce more milk, and people drinking that stuff right there. What's that got to be doing to the person?
Well, these are the things that's going on. I mean, they're using the entire Western world and some parts of the Third World as guinea pigs on a massive scale. I mean, with the chemtrails and with the vaccines. I mean, effectively, when you take a vaccine, they change you from 100% human into part animal, part human. Because some of the RNA and DNA that's in the vaccines will interact with the human and cause changes that should not be done.
And you know, with that said, would you say that could explain why it is that, let's say, if you went back thousands of years, where in the Bible there's stories about people living 500 to 900 years old, and they were able to basically do a whole lot more mentally wise than people can actually do today. Would you say that due to the chemistry and all the genetic modifications that there's a possibility that instead of us at being advanced like that, that we would have brain inhibitors or whatever that would keep us from being able to use these abilities that they were able to use back then?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, I think all the evidence seems to suggest that we're now what I would call the fifth civilization on the planet. There has been four other civilizations that have arrived at our level, or maybe exceeded our level. The human race has been on the planet since, even maybe before the time of the dinosaurs. Do you know what I mean? Because there are footprints of humans in the mud, and alongside it, you can see footprints of dinosaurs. So all the evidence is there. Humans haven't changed, as far as I can see, one bit since the time of the dinosaurs. And the proof is there, because you look sharks. Sharks haven't changed one bit since the time of the dinosaurs. Mosquitoes haven't changed one bit since the time of the dinosaurs. So I don't want to get into what's called the creation versus evolution model, but as far as I'm concerned, evolution, monkey to man in 1 million years, forget it. You know, like, it didn't happen.
All this what? Controversy, no matter which subject that we're talking about, it drives me literally insane, because once you get done talking about it, you still have more questions. Like evolution, right. You know, you talk about evolution, then you also got to talk about what's the deal where the weaker species dies out? Doggone it. I can't remember what it is. Natural selection, you know?
Yeah, well, natural selection. Darwin doesn't mean natural selection, the strong survive. Darwinism is really the weak get massacred. That's what the philosophy was. But to be politically correct, they wrapped it up in this nice term, the strong survive. But the reality is they've been practicing what I call extermination ever since, and probably before Darwin. I mean, you only have to look at, they arrive in Australia, there was at least 20 million aborigines, and they wiped out most of them. You know, I think there's only less than 2 million now. I think they got them down to maybe less than 1 million at one stage. Same with America. They arrived in America, and ever since they arrived, they probably exterminated 14 million native Indians. Many parts of the world have gone. They have systematically exterminated the local population. So, like, there was 200,000 what would be called Hottentots or Bushmen. They were small pygmy-type people who lived in Namibia. And the Germans in 1911 exterminated 200,000 of them. So, you know, extermination is hardwired into the system of education, the system of political control, the system of logic.
Well, all
I can say in there
is I'd love to be a fly on the wall of whoever is at the tip top of the pyramid with all the secret information flowing there. I'd love to be a fly on the wall just to sit there and listen to what all's going on and what's being said, because, you know, like you talk about extermination, you know, that's a conspiracy theory, sure, you know, but look through history of time, man, people went over to other nations and mopped them out of existence, and, you know, there's been wars throughout the entire history of man, you know, and aliens, do they exist or do they don't exist, is Bigfoot real or not, you know, I'm just saying, especially, when you talk about aliens, that really gets under my skin, because, you know, like when the mainstream media starts talking about aliens, they'll show, well, this is plausible, this is unexplained, and then before, like the halfway point of the show, then they start throwing the seed of doubt in there. Okay, do they or don't they? Well, by the time you get done listening to the whole deal, you get a headache because, you know, you haven't learned anything. You know, you've seen where it could be plausible.
Yeah, that's the problem with these subjects. That's why I don't put so much time and energy into them. I'd rather put my time and energy into making my car go 200 miles to the gallon. You know, that's really important for me, you know, getting good miles to the gallon.
Well, you and me both, brother, and that's why I'm into the alternative energy, because it's the only thing that makes any sense to me as far as, you know, I know that we're energy, you know. There's energy around. If you can't find free electricity, you're simply not looking hard enough for it. Now, people sit there and they burst into flames and they call it spontaneous combustion, but there's something going on there. There's some sort of either chemical reaction, a short in the electrical system. Either way, something has really seriously occurred. There's some sort of anomaly there that created enough energy to burn what normally would take a 2,000 degree flame, burn it to ash, and still not affect anything around. You know, like the other parts of the houses aren't burnt up. You know, the house didn't totally catch fire. You see what I'm saying?
Okay. Well, I'll give a good example. Is years ago, people would not believe people when they talked about a phenomenon called ball lightning. You know, they refused to believe that such a thing could exist. But over many years, with cameras and videos and being able to reproduce ball lightning effects in laboratories, they now accept that, you know, ball lightning probably can do what these people have described. You know, it comes down there, maybe the chimney, and it rolls onto the lounge floor, and it rolls about, and it hits an object and explodes, or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe ball lightning is what's causing people to burst into fire, because that could be the spark ignition. You know, it's just a ball lightning comes into the house, and somewhere or other hits the person, then the explosion creates a fire event, and they have the right chemistry at the right time to make it all happen.
Well,
ball lightning probably hits loads of other people.
In the scientific realm,
and that's the end of it, you know.
In the science fiction realm of existence, vampires burst into flames when they get to sunlight.
Yeah, well, you know, like, these could be people describing things that happened in the old days, and the story got changed, you know, one version embellished on another, and yada, 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 you know. Like, lots of civilizations seem to have this, including the Bible, stories of people who go away for 3 days to visit the kingdom of something or other, and they come back, and 300 years has passed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which would suggest time travel of some sort, you know, whether they went into a wormhole or whatever. I mean, there was a very good example of a plane flying from Bermuda to Florida, and the flying time would be normally 5 hours or whatever, and they saw some sort of effect in the distance, and they thought in between the clouds, and then they thought that was the gap that they should take to avoid the bad weather, and next of all, they were over Florida. Now, to have covered that distance, they would have had to fly at 1,000 miles an hour, so, you know, there are weird, wonderful things that happen in the world.
Well, I'm a firm believer in it. There's a whole lot more to this world than meets the eye, man. There ain't nobody could prove me any different, because, you know, after everything I've seen in my lifetime, I'm positive of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's loads of weird and wonderful things. But some of the things have been more easy to prove than others, like ball lightning. Once they were able to make ball lightning in laboratories, they couldn't make it as spectacular as what witnesses claim to have seen. You know, some of them would be the size of a football.
Well,
and the effect might last 2 or 3 minutes.
And that's, you know, that's why I wanted to bring this subject of spontaneous human combustion up, because it's such a controversial subject, and there's all kinds of different theories and ideas on how it could occur, but scientifically, like I said, it does seem plausible to me because of all the chemistry that's in the body.
Well, let's put it this way. There's certainly enough chemistry in the body to ignite a body. I mean, in actual fact, I use the other logic. It's more weird that more bodies don't burst into flames than they do. Because, I mean, if you got all those chemicals and mix them together, you know, like, you'd probably get raided by the FBI for having concocted a combination that's going to be a firebomb. You know what I mean?
Yep.
There's bits of magnesium in this, which is highly flammable. There's bits of phosphorus in this, which is highly flammable. There's a whole string of other very complicated molecules in us that are you know, quite reactive, hydrochloric acid, you name it.
Well,
so
oil and body fat, both a burn.
Yeah, so in actual fact, it's probably more surprising, more people than are bursting into fire.
rather than
the other way around. I don't think the logic that people shouldn't get burst into fire, I'm more just surprised that, hell, with that many chemicals in there, I'm surprised more of them don't burst into fire.
Well, let's just hope that we don't get hit with an energy beam and burst into flames. That would suck.
Well, this is why they're using those kind of weapons. Microwave will enhance the ability for that kind of thing to happen. These new weapons are designed precisely to do that.
And once again, with the whole microwave issue, you know, people say, that just sounds crazy. You know, that's not scientifically plausible. But you look at the doggone microwave, you know, water is a dipole molecule, and so when you throw a microwave through it, you cause those molecules to rock back and forth, which in turn creates heat. And you know that if you leave your stuff in the microwave too long, it will literally finally catch fire.
Oh, yeah, I tell you, I ruined a good microwave. I left chicken in for too long. I mean, you could not get rid of that smell. I just had to throw the thing out. I mean, the thing was like, you know, the apocryphal story where somebody dies in the house and it's there, body's there for weeks. I mean, it was that kind of rotten odor. I mean, it was just nothing you could do to get rid of the odor out of the microwave. So I could throw it in the bin. Perfectly good microwave.
Man.
Never overcook a chicken.
Well, I put my coffee in for 2 minutes one time.
It's evil.
I put my coffee in for 2 minutes one time, but somehow or another hit an extra zero in there and had it in there for 20 minutes and didn't realize it until I had coffee all over the microwave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's quite amazing, all the experiments, you know, all those things and, you know, 200 ways to blow up your microwave. They're always a good laugh to watch on the YouTubes.
So we know that microwaves are a powerful weapon, you know, and if you go by any radio tower, 9 times out of 10, there's usually a sign that says not to stand too close to the tower because otherwise you give yourself a sunburn. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I know one restaurant here, and they got a very good Wi-Fi. It's, you know, good speed, about 6 megs, which is pretty good for a free Wi-Fi service. But every time they turn on the microwave oven, kills the bloody Wi-Fi signal. Because the microwave is 2.5 gigahertz, and most Wi-Fi is 2.5 gigahertz. So it's interfering with it. So
basically, those two fields are coupling together, canceling each other out.
Yeah. So, I mean, whether they need to replace their microwave or what's going on, I don't know. But, I mean, every microwave oven, a certain amount of the signal will get out. It's absolutely impossible to completely stop all the microwaves getting out of a microwave oven. But they're designed to not allow an excessive amount out. I mean, they're shielding something like 99.9%. But that 0.1% is probably still more powerful than the Wi-Fi machine, and the Wi-Fi router might be too close to it, and it's blocking it out.
Yeah. You know. Well, we've talked about all kinds of stuff, and a lot of it sounded crazy, man. But if you literally think about all the different facts and the evidence and all that kind of stuff, and weigh it in there with some basic science, you know, there's something definitely going on. You know, I may sound crazy, but you know, that's my view on the deal. What do you think?
Oh yeah. Look, there's a lot of weird stuff, but I try to get down to the nitty-gritties with everything. Like, for example, I'm trying to establish this HHO business, you know, converting the hydrogen and oxygen. Does it really give you more miles per gallon? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think even just with the fossil fuel alone, just with gasoline alone, it's the method by which they inject this fuel in is the weak point why they can't get more mileage out of it. Because you know as well as I do that fumes will combust faster than a spray, you know.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's what happened in the early days. As far as I can see, gasoline in the early days was more like Coleman's fuel. I don't know. Have you ever had a can of the cooking...
Yeah, I got some of that.
Yeah. If you open the cap on that in your garage, and you leave the cap open for half an hour, and half the fuel will be in your garage. You strike a match, and you're going to blow your garage to bits.
Yeah, well, I don't want to do that.
I know. Well, it's incredibly volatile fuel. That's what it, that's why I really think the Americans use the correct word when they call, we call it petrol, but the real word should really be gasoline. Because the original gasoline was far more like a gas than a liquid. At the slightest opportunity, it vaporized into a gas. And then it would go into the cylinder basically as a gas as opposed to droplets of liquid. And I mean, if you look at the Model T Ford car, they were designed to run on the 1920s gasoline at the time. And I mean, if you watch any movie, somebody opens the gasoline tank in a garage, they say, close that quickly! So literally, the fumes would come out of that gasoline tank and go across the garage to where they might have a heater and blow the whole garage to bits.
So with that said...
That was scared stupid of that fuel.
Yeah.
But it did vaporize, and that's how these guys made carburetors that would vaporize fuel and get cars to do 200 miles a gallon.
So with that said, why haven't the general population out there, I'm not talking about the mainstream mechanics slash auto industry or whatever, or fuel industries, why hasn't the average Joe out there tried to build a vaporizer that would let the fumes up from the fuel tank itself and then basically inject those fumes into the carburetor?
Well, all my research indicates that lots of guys did exactly that. A lot of guys in the backstreet garage, they were building vaporizers, and the fuel was vaporizing, and it would go into the engine, and they were getting, instead of 20 miles a gallon, they were getting 100 miles a gallon. And the oil companies, you know, one or two of them would then get clever and say, oh, I'm going to patent it and make a whole load of money. And the oil companies would get wind of it, and what they would do is they deliberately change the formula for the gasoline so that there would be something that would poison the carburetor. Do you know what I mean? It might create, might be an acid that might cause the carburetor to stop working properly after a short time or whatever. And so every single attempt from the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, every time somebody builds a carburetor that will vaporize the new formula gasoline, they go and change the formula for the gasoline. So it will no longer function with that carburetor. So the trouble with chasing the vaporization route is until you can stop, you can get a fixed formula gasoline to be given to you by the oil companies, there's no point in going down the fuel vaporization route, because they'll just change the formula of the fuel so that carburetor no longer functions.
Well, that don't surprise me none either. You know, it just drives me insane. I remember back in the old days, you got some gas in your car. It seemed like it'd last a whole lot longer. Now they're putting things like ethanol and different stuff like that in there. It seems like the fuel burns up faster, but you don't get near as many miles out of it. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. The reason, if I have a car and I modify it to run on alcohol, say 100% alcohol, and say before that the car was doing 20 miles a gallon on gasoline, I'll be very lucky to get 12 miles a gallon out of pure alcohol. Because, think about this logically, the gasoline molecule has no oxygen attached to it. So it has to get all the oxygen to burn from the atmosphere. So the mix ratio is 15 to 1. The alcohol is 30%
oxygen attached to the molecule. Well, if you've got 30% oxygen attached to the molecule, you now have 30% less carbon and hydrogen to burn as fuel. So you're going to get 30% less miles to gallon. End of story. Do you know what I mean?
I talked to a guy who builds them alcohol burner go-karts, and I was asking him what you had to do to actually change a 5-horse Briggs & Stratton over to burn alcohol. And he said, well, all you got to do is change the injectors, you know. And so essentially, I guess he was putting a smaller pinhole-style injector inside the carburetor in order to get this fuel to run right.
No, actually, what you got to do, there's a couple of things you got to do to make a car engine or any engine run correctly on alcohol. You've got to increase the flow of the fuel by 30%. Because if you're getting 30% less fuel, you've got to make it up from somewhere. So you've got to make a bigger hole for the carburetor needle.
So he was putting larger injectors in there?
Yeah, larger injectors into it. Now, the other thing too is alcohol as a fuel is very reluctant to burn. The same with petrol, gasoline. Gasoline nowadays is very reluctant to burn compared to the old-fashioned gasoline. So what you have to do is you have to advance the timing, because as the piston is coming up, if you wait till it's top dead center and you ignite the spark plug, by the time the piston's reached the bottom of the stroke, the fuel's only starting to burn up. So you, as the piston is coming up, you have to ignite the fuel maybe 10 degrees ahead or 15 or 20, depending on the fuel that you got in there. So typically with a petrol engine, it's 7 degrees in advance. It's what they call 7 degrees in advance of top dead center. You ignite the spark plug and start the fuel to catch fire. So that by the time the piston is at top dead center, it's now starting to ignite completely and push the piston down. Well, alcohol is even more reluctant to catch fire, so you need a bigger spark plug, a more powerful one, and you have to ignite the ignition even sooner, I think like 20 degrees or whatever. And will push the piston down correctly.
How did the moonshiners back in the day used to run their car on grain alcohol?
Yeah, well, this is the Model T Ford was designed to run on both alcohol and on gasoline. And that's what happened. Well, if you look at the old Model T Ford, I've talked to the guys who've got a few copies of them. And There's a gadget on the side of the steering wheel, and it's actually, you can advance and retard the ignition by pushing the stick backwards and forwards.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. It's incredibly interesting how the old-fashioned guys did it. I mean, it was real do-it-by-touch logic, you know. So if they filled up the tank with gasoline, they needed to retard the ignition back to the minimum. If they fill the tank with alcohol, completely on the alcohol, they had to push the stick to the maximum and advance. Now, quite often, they would have half a tank of gasoline and half a tank of alcohol, depending where which place they bought their fuel. So they had to put the stick in the middle. And the problem was to know exactly the right place. So what they would do is they'd push the stick forward so that they advance the ignition too much, and the engine would start pinging, you know, that pre-detonation, ding, 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 ding,
yeah.
Right? And then they'd pull the stick back a bit, and that was the right setting for the engine to operate at.
Well, I've heard stories about them actually running it on straight grain alcohol, so that if they ever got chased by the revenuers, so to speak, that they would have to, they could outrun them, they could burn off all the evidence.
Yeah, well, that would help, yeah. But what actually happened was the Rockefeller, he had all the oil companies, and he didn't want no competition for nothing. You know, competition for the Rockefeller was a sin. And most farmers in those days, if they were traveling across America or traveling anywhere and they wanted fuel, every farm at the front door or out in the front area would have a sign saying alcohol for sale. And they'd pull in, stop, and fill up their car with alcohol, which was made by every farmer. So you didn't need petrol stations. there was no requirement. Every dirt road that went down, you'd always find fuel. And Rockefeller didn't like that. You know, he didn't like the fact that Ford cars were designed to run on alcohol and gasoline. Because up to that time, he had no use for gasoline. He'd been throwing it in rivers as a useless fuel. There was no requirement for it until cars came along. So he devised that he spent $1 billion, which is a lot of money at the time, and he got all the religious nutcases in America to say alcohol's the root of all evil and it's bad voodoo and the devil knows what, and we got to ban alcohol. And that's what brought in prohibition. Now, after 10 years, running car engines, every car engine got modified to run on petrol. And they no longer had this ability to change the engine to run on the two fuels on the fly, so to speak. Right?
That kind of stinks. That means I can't put a steel in the trunk of my car and run my car off of a liquor.
Yeah. So, 10 years later or whatever, 20 years later, I don't know how long prohibition lasted. When prohibition got finally stopped, it didn't matter. All cars were running on petrol or gasoline. And he recouped his $1 billion tenfold or 20-fold or 100-fold because he now had gasoline stations all along all the highways and in every town and city. And people who used to run the car in alcohol forgot all about it. And they still kept the laws about producing alcohol for your own use. You were restricted to quite small amounts. If you want to make alcohol, you still got to go and get a license. In the old days, you just made alcohol. There was no ifs and buts about it. You just made it. like your moonshiners.
So I guess if I want to get me a generator that runs on pure alcohol, I'm going to have to go out and find an old Model T Ford motor.
Well, it's very easy. Every engine will, petrol engine will quite easily run alcohol, but it doesn't run it very efficiently because the petrol engine is designed to run efficiently on petrol. If you want an alcohol engine to run efficiently, it should be designed to run on alcohol from the word go. Instead of having a compression ratio of 10 to 1, the compression ratio should be more like 16 to 1, more like a diesel engine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe even 20 to 1, I forget. It's quite a high compression ratio you need to get gasoline to burn correctly, and then you will recoup back some of the losses, because the trouble with alcohol in a petrol engine is it's not being compressed to its ideal compression ratio function. But a petrol engine cannot produce too much compression or it starts to pre-detonate fuel. You know, as the piston's going up and compressing the fuel, eventually the heat inside the compression chamber is so high it ignites the fuel without the spark plug. And you start to get pre-detonation, which burns holes in the pistons. So the solution to that is to not have too high a compression ratio for petrol engines, gasoline engines. Now, in the old days, the compression ratio of a Model T Ford was about 6 to 1, right?
So, we know it can be done. It's just a matter of the fuel companies and the auto industry not wanting to do it. So, the average Joe is at the mercy of actually trying to build it themselves. So if I was going to build me up,
that's part of the problem. But there's a lot more complications in the pipeline than just they don't want to. There is problems to do with they've been modifying the fuel every few years. Gasoline now require, in the old days, the original gasoline, it couldn't operate with a compression ratio of higher than 6 to 1, the old Model T Ford. I mean, a Model T Ford engine was a 3-liter engine and produced 25 brake horsepower. A modern petrol engine with 3-liter will produce close to 200 horsepower. So you can see that's a tenfold increase in horsepower from the same size engine. But one engine is operating on a compression ratio of 10.5 to 1. Which is actually lower than it was in the 60s. In the 60s, it was 12 to 1 because they used pure gasoline. Nowadays, they use 5% alcohol, so they have to reduce the compression ratio. And so as each time they do a change to the formula fuel, for the next 10 years, everything is trapped into that type of fuel. You get what I say?
Yeah, I'm
it's
hip.
More than just they don't want to, it's they have, you know, the car manufacturers and the fuel manufacturers and the and a whole load of people are involved in deciding that this is going to be the next fuel that we're going to use for the next 10, 20 years, which is about the lifetime of most cars.
So do you know of any engine out there at all that will run on straight alcohol right out the box?
Yeah, there's some cars that are designed to run on straight alcohol, E85, but they'll run on straight alcohol out of the box, you know. But there's no fuel company supplying straight alcohol. Those are what's called flex fuel cars.
You know they got that show on TV about the modern day moonshiners, right?
Yeah. No, I haven't seen that. That's not a show that they're showing over here, I can tell you.
Oh, well, they got this over here in the States.
They might have put ideas in people's heads.
Yeah, I'm just saying, you know, maybe we could figure out a way to build the system kind of like, you know, when you want to get hydrogen on demand, you have alcohol on demand, so it only created as you need it?
possible, but I wouldn't say likely. The more easy way would try and make methanol. I don't know if you know methanol.
Well, I'm kind of familiar with it, but we're running short on time here, brother.
Not bad alcohol. There are four or five different alcohols. There's ethanol, alcohol, the stuff that makes you drunk and it's safe to drink in small quantities, you know, 5%, 10% of your, by volume in your liquid.
Well, I don't necessarily want to get drunk.
Maximum 50% if it's moonshine.
I just want to be able to run an engine because the internal combustion engine, we know it works. We know the steam engine works. We know the Stirling engine works. And we know we can burn water for fuel. It's just a matter of trying to find out the most efficient way to do it.
What I'm trying to get back to is a problem called scaling, right? There is a big problem with scaling. For example, the steam engine is probably the most efficient engine you can use from 0 to 10 horsepower, right? But after 10 horsepower, it becomes quite inefficient. And then at around about 600 horsepower upwards, the steam engine starts to become very efficient again. And that's why the internal combustion engine is very popular to use between 10 horsepower and 600 horsepower. It tends to work best in that area.
But I only need 5 horsepower to connect it to a generator head.
Yeah. Well, then you probably are better off looking at steam, because steam is more efficient in the 0 to 10 horsepower area than any... internal combustion engine.
Well,
it's to do with scaling. The ideal cylinder size for a burning gasoline is somewhere between 250 cc's and 350 cc's. I don't know what it is for diesel, but I would imagine diesel is probably between 500 and 1 liter. Do you mean?
Yeah.
If you make a very small piston like what you would have on a, say, 50cc motorbike, you're not going to get very much efficiency out of the burning of the fuel because of a problem called scaling. You know what I mean?
Well, what do them little model airplane planes run on?
Well, this is it. They're incredibly inefficient. I mean, they fly and they're great fun and everything else. Most of them are running on methanol because once you go below 10cc, petrol won't burn properly inside such a small cylinder. So the only fuel that will tend to burn correctly in a small cylinder will be methanol. Now, you can make small petrol engines burn, but they tend to run very rough because what happens in such a small scale, the fuel tends to form droplets instead of forming a fine mist. And it's a fine mist that you need to burn. Now, ideally, vapor is even better. I mean, the champion of model airplanes got one small model airplane. An American guy, I forget his name, Bill something or other. I think about the year 2002 or that year, he got a small model airplane to fly across the Atlantic using a 10cc engine that was burning Coleman's fuel.
Cool.
This is where I discovered that he was clearly using vaporization. I mean, no matter what way I ran the numbers, he used 2.5 kilos of fuel to get a 5-kilo plane across the Atlantic, which is 2,000 miles.
And I think that bears looking into the whole vaporization. Say, Dublin, we're down to like the last 4 minutes of the show, so I'll give you the last couple minutes to say whatever you want to say to people, and then we'll head up out of here with a tune, and then after my show is Beverly's Hope Show, so I hope everybody stays tuned.
Right. What I want to throw out is something. Can everybody verify and check this at some stage if they get a chance? I'm running the numbers that a typical 3-liter car doing 60 mile an hour, say 20 miles to the gallon, USA gallon, if you look at each piston stroke, say probably it will be doing about 3,000 RPM, it would suggest that each piston stroke would probably be about 250 times in a minute, right, of explosion, because, you know, this is a 4-stroke engine. On, say, a 6-pot engine, say 6-cylinder, 500 cc's to each cylinder, 1/10 of a gram of fuel goes into the engine on each explosion, and that translates, as best as I can figure out, to about 1 watt of power. So this suggests, I mean, 1 watt of power is very, very small. I don't know how 1 watt of power is pushing those big pistons up and down, but it looks like that's what goes on in the internal combustion engine. And for want of a better word, that's more like a pop-pop engine, because you've got 1 watt of power pushing 250 times in a second, this piston up and down. You know, I mean, so now in 1 minute, 250 watts of power has been produced from each piston. And then that over so many miles, you know, when you use 1 liter, turns into 9 kilowatts and yada, yada, yada. But if anybody could run those numbers, I'm trying to work out exactly how much power is used in each piston stroke.
Yeah, that'd be some good information to know. Say, we're down to the last couple minutes, so I got to bug up out of here. Thanks to everybody out there for listening to Shazoo's Mad Science. Stay tuned tomorrow for the Knights of the Round Table. You going to be around tomorrow, Dublin?
I'll do my best. I can't promise. Crazy things happen here. This is Spain.
All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show. I'll catch up with you later, brother.
Yeah.
All right.
Peace,
take care.
Hopefully. Yeah.
Peace.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds, are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid.